Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, registered veterinary technician, Becky Mosser, and this week we are live from New York Vet, having a wonderful time sitting down and speaking with some of the presenters at this week's conference. We're getting all the tips and tricks that you can take and apply to practice, and this guest is one everybody needs to take a listen to because she has got some great information, and she is actually a friend of the podcast. She's been here before, Dr. Elaine Blay.
You bet. Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming back and having a conversation with us.
Glad to be here.
So we are talking about something really important here today, right? So first and foremost, USP Chapter 800.
Yes.
What is that?
That can't easily be answered in a single sentence. That kind of underscores the depth of this particular topic. But if you were to just kind of summarize it, USP 800 are some guidelines that have been developed by United States Pharmacopeia. That's where the USP comes from. So people will shorten it by saying USP. And they specifically deal with worker protection. So anybody in a healthcare environment, nurse, physician, veterinary technician, veterinarian, pharmacist, it does not matter, who comes into contact with any type of hazardous drugs, there's got to be some procedures and protocols in place, certain types of equipment and or engineering controls, just a whole laundry list of things to protect that worker's personal health. That's what it comes down to. It's not exclusive to patient safety, even though you can't say that this absolutely is all about patient safety. It has more to do with the person handling the drug, touching the drug, administering the drug, or cleaning up metabolites of the drug in an animal's poop, pee, vomitus, storing the drug, mixing it, compounding it, so it's worker safety.
And this is a long time coming, right? Like this is, we need this.
Yes, absolutely. USP guidelines, and there's several of them, just to kind of give you a little background here. Perhaps veterinarians have heard of USP 795. There's USP 797, and now there's USP 800. And these are, again, all set forward by United States Pharmacopeia. And they've been kind of years in the making, and they'll kind of be drafted by stakeholders and experts, and then there's typically some kind of review or comment period, and they'll come back and they'll kind of massage those and make them even, like, incorporate the changes, and then they're kind of put out there as general guidelines, practice guidelines. 797, USP 797, veterinarians need to know about that because pharmacy needs to be compliant with USP 797 if they compound non-sterile pharmaceuticals for a veterinarian, such as a suspension or a tablet or a treat form. Then if a pharmacy compounds sterile products for a veterinarian, that's 797. So TPN, chemotherapy, something injectable. So it's along the same lines from 795 to 797, then USP developed to 800. So you can talk about patient safety, which is 795 and 797, highly focused, but then it focused on worker safety. So USP has been putting all of these guidelines together for years and massaging them, expert opinions, expert commentary, and then they have finally come out with the finalized version of those. And USP 800 was really kind of finalized in 2016 with an implementation date or going live, so to speak, of December 1st, 2019. So they kind of gave industry a little while to gear up and recognize. But, you know, the hard and fast is here. It's coming up quickly.
Okay, so what is that hard and fast? What is it they've got to be geared up for?
Yeah, compliance with USP 800, honestly, compliance. And it's, you know, compliance is always a scary word to people, right? So if you're non-compliant, right, that's like getting a speeding ticket or the police coming and knocking on your door and you're arresting you, right? Or if you're non-compliant with something, it's punitive typically, right? And that scares people.
Sure.
So, you know, I think veterinarians, when you ask the question, are you compliant with USP 800? You know, the compliance part alone says, that kind of scares me. I don't even know what USP 800 means, but the fact that you use the word compliance kind of makes me, you know, wet my britches a little bit,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So there has to be some education on this and kind of, I think, de-escalate the panic that is accompanying USP 800 interpretation in veterinary medicine. It is achievable, but I think you have to educate yourself.
I love that you're, you know, part of this is not to scare people, it's get educated, yep. So there's nothing to be scared about. So what are the elements of compliance what makes someone compliant or non-compliant with USP 800?
So USP 800 puts forth some very strict, explicit guidelines in terms of ear engineering controls, training of personnel, personal protective equipment, and they're actually quite lengthy. Anybody can go online to USP, United States Pharmacopeia, and get a free download of USP 800, and you can kind of read through that. So if you were to just download USP 800, it's a PDF of about 20 pages, so that alone says, oh my goodness, that's scary, right? But you have to kind of read through that and be able to say, yes, this does apply to me, and I need to accept that and develop protocols and procedures for my particular clinic, or, you know, that's probably more applicable to a sterile products compounding pharmacy, not necessarily a general practice. So just recognizing it, reading through it, and kind of jumping in that way is, I think, the first and best way to approach this, education of oneself.
And so this is going to affect general practice differently than it's going to affect specialty, than it's going to affect emergency. There's going to be some differences in how people are affected. Can you kind of just outline what that means a little bit for the different areas of veterinary medicine?
You bet. So USP categorizes hazardous drugs, and a hazardous drug is kind of anything that's been linked to a negative health effect or outcome. And so USP categorizes them into three different categories. So the first one being anti-neoplastics, and that's pretty self-explanatory. Any medical professional could say, yes, I understand that's a hazardous drug. Category number two is non-anti-neoplastic drugs. And here's where it can kind of rope in general practice, because some of the non-anti-neoplastic drugs, spironolactone, cyclosporin, chloramphenicol, and those are just a few, methimazole, those are just a few. And then the third category are drugs that affect any type of reproductive methods, either in a male or female, women who are trying to get pregnant, women who are currently pregnant. And so they have reproductive negative effects on reproduction or health of a pregnancy. So those are the three categories. So general practice, maybe if you're a general practitioner, you might have to kind of look over those drugs in category number two. And maybe the production animal medicine or food animal vets out there are saying, whew, so glad I don't have to deal with any of this. Wait, put on the brakes, okay? Because even though these drugs, they're all human drugs, there are still some veterinary drugs that are considered hazardous. And so if you're a food animal practitioner and you use any of the prostaglandin F2 alpha drugs, such as dinoprost or clopidogrel, those absolutely have negative side effects on a reproductive age woman, particularly one who is pregnant. So it even applies to production animal medicine veterinarians.
You know, I'm glad you're bringing this up, because I think about how often I hear, especially on the support staff side, it's like, I'm pregnant. That's not a confession. This is a story. like you say, like, oh, I'm pregnant, and what do I need to change or look out for? And so often the feedback I hear from other support staff members is like, well, other than radiology and like, oh, I didn't do, you know, but they're really not maybe taking care of themselves the way, not, you know, intentionally, obviously, yes. But we're putting ourselves at risk. And I know this to be true, because even with the drugs, things like anti-neoplastics that we know can be really dangerous, I see a lot of mishandling.
Yes, yes.
Like terrifyingly scary mishandling.
Yes.
And I don't always know that support staff know that they're at risk, right? Because we don't always have the background knowledge. So what does this mean for support staff? What are you telling support staff about this? Like, do they need to go out and read these too?
It applies to everybody, whether you're a support staff, whether you're a practice owner, a practice manager, an associate veterinarian, owner veterinarian, I don't care. It applies to anybody and everybody who touches a hazardous substance at any point in its life cycle. And again, life cycle can be from the minute it hits your door, perhaps coming from a pharmacy or a wholesale distributor, all the way out to disposal. Whether you're disposing of an IV set that was used to administer a chemo drug, all the way to disposal of poop, pee, vomitous waste products were metabolites of these anti-neoplastics. So it applies to everybody. And so entire spectrum of job responsibilities. So everybody under the roof of that vet clinic needs to be aware of these and educated on these. And one of the big components of USP 800 is employee training, or not necessarily employee, but anybody. They could be a volunteer, right? The high school kid who comes in to clean kennels on a Thursday afternoon, right? He may not be a paid employee, but he's still under that roof, might have exposure to hazardous drugs. So everybody's got to be educated. And that's one of the components of USP 800, is educating and making sure people can demonstrate that they are compliant, and then you document that they are compliant. And so education is just one of several large categories of USP 800.
What about for our clients?
Yes, education as well. So particularly anti-neoplastics. And even some of the non-antineoplastics, anything that would be administered in the home environment, or perhaps administration of a cancer drug in clinic, and then they're sent home 6 hours later to the home environment. And so owners still need to be aware of vomitus, poop pee, that can contain antineoplastics, so they need to be educated. Yes, owners are not exempt. They simply don't handle it, so to speak. They might administer, say, an oral formulation, and they still need to be, you know, educated on that, some oral cyclophosphamide tablets, but they don't carry the same liability that a licensed professional does, such as a veterinarian.
Yeah.
So they're kind of the end of the line, but that doesn't exempt them from needing to know about the hazards that are associated with these drugs.
So what's going to look different when this goes into effect in December? Like, how will things be different for us?
That's a good question. I think it's going to look different for different types of practices. If you are a veterinary oncology practice and you mix, compound, administer your own chemotherapy under your own roof, it's going to be significant in terms of gearing up with the engineering controls, the equipment, the training, the personal protective equipment, education of anybody and everybody under that roof that comes into contact with these. For a general practitioner, it's probably going to focus on a little bit more of the non-antineoplastic drugs, and you can kind of minimize some of the risk. And one way of doing that is ordering drugs in what, in pharmacy terms, we call a final dosage form or a unit package, unit of use package. So ordering, say, your spironolactone, instead of a 100-count bottle, you might order it the way hospitals will order it, where each individual tablet is put into an individual kind of foil overlay and has to be open. So that minimizes exposure, right, to a vet tech who's maybe dispensing it. So they're kind of self-contained. That's one way to a general practice it might look like to them. And again, even food animal practice, it's going to look a little bit different in terms of acquisition, storage, dispensing, administering of any drugs such as your prostaglandin LFT alphas that anybody could be exposed to. So I think what it's going to look like, it's going to kind of depend on what your practice is.
Who's enforcing this? Like, when we talk about compliance, like, who's showing up at our door to find out if we're compliant?
Yeah, exactly. And so here I would be funny and say the USP 800 police are going to come thundering and knocking down your door. Nope. So these are guidelines. And what is typically happening on the human side, so let me focus on pharmacy just to kind of compare and contrast. So these guidelines are published, and USP is a nonprofit. They're not a government organization, so to speak. They're made up of experts. But they draft these guidelines, and then many times a board will adopt those. So on the pharmacy side, most state boards of pharmacy have adopted USP 797 and 795 into their own state practice act. So then a board of pharmacy has jurisdiction to make sure an individual pharmacy or pharmacist in charge has met those requirements. And they can, you know, if there is non-compliance, they could suspend a license or fine a license, things along those lines. Vet side, I think it's a little bit different, because, and that's a very good question. I don't think anybody can absolutely say, here's the enforcer, because to date, I don't know that there has been widespread acceptance of USP 800 into the Veterinary Practice Acts.
Okay.
However, OSHA, okay, which is federal, okay, can be an enforcer, and that's who we think probably the primary enforcer of USP 800 will be, not only to veterinary medicine, but also, in addition, human medicine as well, if it's not already in a Pharmacy Practice Act.
So other than USP, where are you sending people for more resources and information on this? How are you kind of helping get the word out and get some knowledge to people who want to know?
So I would encourage everybody to go to USP.org, UnitedStatesPharmacopeia.org, and you can get a free download of USP 800. You just simply have to register for it, and then they'll send you an email, and you can print from there. And like I said, it's about a 20-page PDF document. There's a nice app out there called HazRx, H-A-Z-R-X, and you can buy that for about $3.99. And it's not so much to help one become compliant, but it's more awareness level. So you can kind of look up a drug. Oh, is it considered a hazardous drug? Under what category? And it is updated continuously. But in terms of writing extensive protocols or training, that app will not accomplish that. It's more kind of a real-time, just quick overview of the drug itself. Is it considered hazardous? And what about makes it hazardous? Is this because it's an antineoplastic or the ability to alter one's DNA? Or is it hazardous because it could terminate terminate a pregnancy to an unknown pregnant woman. So it kind of classifies the hazards in particular. There are some larger companies out there, for-profit companies, who have anticipated this need. And you could do a Google search and I think find several that are specific to veterinary medicine who have kind of written out some policies and procedures that you could adopt within your clinic, or they're kind of helping you with risk awareness. They can help with personnel training, can help with disposal. So, you know, that's kind of the starting place. Read USP, download the app if you're a user of the app. And I would say if you feel that you need extra guidance, investigate perhaps some of the companies out there that will provide that.
Plum's Veterinary Drugs is the must-have veterinary drug resource. With Plum's Veterinary Drugs, your number one source for drug information can always be right at your fingertips, on your phone, your tablet, or your desktop, wherever you need it. To learn more and subscribe, visit plumsveterinarydrugs.com.
At this point in time, I think it's really an important thing to discuss that if you are a subscriber to Plum's Veterinary Drugs, they will soon start incorporating as part of each drug's monograph, if it is a hazardous drug, exactly what that hazard is. So safety data sheet information, or it's a hazardous drug perhaps because it's a category X for pregnant women, right? And so you can kind of assess that type of information for a risk assessment from your practice standpoint.
What I love about that, besides the fact that I love Plum's, because it gives us all that information, though, is like you don't have to go about looking for it, right? Because it sounds like there are a lot of really great resources, but you might have to poke about looking for them. And what I really like with the PVD or Plum's Veterinary Drugs is that there's an app, and that is going to be incredibly up to date, and that everybody can kind of access it. So if your vet isn't maybe on top of that or looking out for you for that or realizes that, or you know, or maybe you're pregnant or you think you might be pregnant and you're not ready to tell anybody in the practice and you need this information confidentially on your own, it's easy to get, you know, and I think that's really important. You know, a while back we did a podcast and just realized how much exposure to like zoonotic drugs we get or zoonotic diseases we have in the veterinary industry without even knowing. And I think this is the same thing. I think on a day-to-day basis, we put ourselves at risk way more than we realize, way more than we know, or even sometimes we do know. And I guess we just like feel better. Like we think it's not a problem. I can't, I mean, when it comes to x-ray safety, when it comes to drug safety, I see a lot of that and it's kind of scary. And I like to, and want to encourage all veterinary professionals, anybody in the clinic, like you said, even that volunteer, to know what they're handling, know what they're dealing with. It's really important, and you have to get that knowledge yourself and empower yourself, right? So it's great that there's these resources. Just kind of encapsulate this for me, like where do clinics start? Where do they end? Yeah. What else do they need to know? Just like summarize this the best you can for me so we can get it out there.
You bet. It's hard to talk about USP 800 and summarize it because it's extensive. So if I were just to kind of summarize it as best I can here today for veterinary medicine, and so again, I'm not kind of talking about how USP 800 will apply to a compounding pharmacy, but just veterinary medicine. First off, designate someone within the practice. Is this going to be part of their job description to know this, to understand this, to document? Who's going to be that person? They need to go to USP 800, download that particular guideline, and read through it. They need to go to the lists of drugs, and NIOSH is the one who categorizes those category 1, 2s, and 3s, and just kind of say, yes, we do not carry any category 1s in our clinic. Don't have to be worried about that level of exposure to hazardous drugs. Look at category 2s. I think a lot of general practice as well as specialty referral will say, ooh, yeah, we use a lot of drugs that are in category 2. So just kind of recognize what drugs are in your practice that are currently considered a hazardous drug. And from there, you kind of, that person or responsible person kind of does what we call a gap analysis. So here's kind of what drugs we have, and here's how they're currently treated, handled, stored, procured, disposed of, right? And here's what the guidelines say, how we should store, handle, administer, procure, dispose of, and kind of as look at that analysis. What's the difference between what we're doing now and what the standards say we have to do? Then you kind of take the approach of, okay, we need to make sure we're compliant, to come up with some training with mechanical or engineering controls, personal protective of equipment is a big one. So if you're counting out cyclophosphamide tablets, certainly, or spironolactone or methimazole, any more these days, if that's a drug that you handle in your practice, there needs to be respiratory protection, right? That technician probably needs to be gloved up, typically two gloves. There needs to be a impermeable Tyvek type of a clothing protector, protecting face. Some of these drugs, particularly if it's an injectable, can be absorbed through skin and mucous membranes. So recognizing, wow, we need to provide some PPE, personal protective equipment, to people who are handling these drugs right now in our clinic. Education is another significant component. And if you don't, it's not that you have to sit down and write education out. You can go to some of these companies that are supporting healthcare and becoming compliant, and they have some of these education guides. They can walk you through them, but you have to educate everybody within the practice. You have to document that education. If they're handling injectables in particular, they have to be able to demonstrate that they're meeting practice guidelines by demonstrating, yes, I can handle this, say, chemo drug appropriately, and I'm using what we call a closed system transfer device, and I can demonstrate to you that I'm doing it correctly. So documentation, education, documentation, making safety data sheet available to everybody in the clinic. Those are just some of the starting points, and it gets more, you know, involved if you do deal with some of the category one drugs in particular. But even a general practice, you know, you might be thinking, well, I don't handle chemo drugs, I don't compound them, I don't administer them. Oh, but wait, occasionally I might use some vincristine, vinblastine to cause, you know, platelet release in some of my ITP patients. Okay, well then, yeah, you do. That's a whole, you know, that is a hazardous drug that needs a whole different approach because it's an injectable. There needs to be some engineering controls, closed system transfer device usage of that, personal protective equipment, education of the person who's administering it or cleaning up after it. So it opens all new doors. So, you know, do that risk analysis.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. And it's a good starting point within the clinic. And it, you know, it sounds like, again, you know, I love to say it, a great place to utilize support staff. This is, there's somebody in your office to champion this that maybe, you know, has the time and wants to, you know, take this project on. And it's definitely something we want to be compliant on, just because we want to be taking better care of ourselves and, yes, and better care of our staff and coworkers. Anything else we need to know?
No, I think that's a good starting point. I would say, you know, sometimes there's the inclination to say, oh, I'm not going to mess with this. It's not that big of a deal to me. And you go back to the enforcement or the compliant piece of that. And you might say, you know, I'm not worried about OSHA coming to my door. I think one of the underlying concerns any practice should have is that if someone under your employ is exposed to these and there's a development of a negative health outcome, that exposes you to some legal liability. And I think that is where, you know, some of the underlying concern comes from. And if you are not kind of at least educating yourself on USP 800, showing at least some initiative to meet those guidelines, not educating your staff, not providing just even the most basic PPE, I understand you are probably very exposed in terms of liability.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a great point. We gotta, you know, protect ourselves legally and for health status. So this is important stuff. I love that you've taken the time to be here to talk about it, be on the podcast and talk about it, getting the word out here at New York Vet. Thank you so much for doing that. The brilliant Dr. Elaine Blight, thank you so much for being here. You know we're gonna have you back.
Anytime.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us, and thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. We appreciate if you leave us all the stars. You can listen to podcasts as well on our website at clinicians.brief.com/podcasts. You can find us at facebook.com/clinicians.brief, on Twitter at clinicians.brief, and on Instagram at clinicians.brief. You can also drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief, the podcast, is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ustry, sound by Randall Stupka, hosted by me, Becky Mosser, with special thanks to production assistant Michelle Monkrez.